Good morning, everyone. I could not be more proud to have the opportunity to introduce Dr. Judy Simpson then. I have known her for many, many years as she was one of my attendings during residency. The things I loved about her in residency were her spunk, her amazing energy, and what a great teacher she was. She left us in our faculty to go to UCF to start a pediatric and adolescent gynecology program, which is truly flourishing. And despite being so, so busy with that, she still finds time to offer wonderful, wonderful services to her community, both here and abroad. She started a student-run free healthcare clinic. She also does work with migrant farm workers. And she even travels to Peru annually to provide wonderful healthcare to the people of Peru. You know, so she lays around eating bonbons all day, as you can tell. She's also a wonderful wife to Juan and has two wonderful, wonderful young, well, older boys now. They were little kids when I was around before. Come on up, Judy.
Thank you so much, Kate. That was so, such a sweet introduction. All right, good. We got all this. I love taking care of teens, and I'm delighted to be here this morning, and I apologize to those of you who thought you were getting the HPV lecture because we switched it up today. I'm going to be covering the modern management of menstrual disorders in adolescents. I have absolutely no financial relationships that are relevant to this talk at all. I actually have almost no financial relationships outside the paycheck from UCF. I absolutely am passionate about care of teens. I have a ball every day at work. What am I going to cover today? Basically, what I'd like to cover are what are the most likely causes of menstrual disorders in adolescents, and it's not the same as your adult population. How do you work them up? What do you really need to look for? And how does the management differ in our teens versus in our adults? Also, I'm going to give you some basic tips and tricks for taking care of adolescents in your clinic. ACOG recently updated its adolescent guide. It used to be called the Teen Toolkit for Teens. They've changed it now just to be called the Adolescent Guide, and it's available online, but you can also order these posters for your clinic. And these are the 21 reasons to see a gynecologist before you turn 21. Why 21? Because obviously they don't need a pap smear until they're 21. But there are plenty of reasons why they really need you. That it can be from their general health, management of menstrual disorders, discussion of sexuality and relationships, management of pregnancy issues, obviously, and sexually transmitted infection screening. And we can do a lot of that even with just with urine these days. What are the most common reasons for an adolescent to come to your clinic? Well, usually it's menstrual disorders, so that's what I'm going to focus on more today than anything else. But we also have a lot of girls with pelvic pain. That's a whole other talk. Ovarian masses we've just heard about. With the caveat with ovarian masses that fortunately my job's a little easier and that almost all of mine, but not all, are benign. We have a lot of patients coming in. How many of you all are seeing labial hypertrophy patients in your practices? Oh my God, the internet is killing us. They all think they're abnormal. And really, I have a book for those of you who have to take care of these girls called Petals. I don't know if you've seen it. It's by a guy named Nick Karras, and it has a lot of very tasteful black and white pictures, like petals of a flower. This is how different everybody's vulva is. And I take it into my patients' rooms with them, and I say, hey, this is what a normal vulva looks like. It looks like a whole variety of things. It's not this style. Stylized tiny drawing. Because I have girls as young as 12 and 13 being brought by their mothers for labial reduction surgery, and that's ludicrous. They're usually fine. Unless they're getting a lot of hair tourniquets, they need to be avoided. Obviously, we have vaginal discharges and odors that we take care of. That's the number one thing Googled by all women. Why does my vagina have an odor? There was a study done on that. So a lot of reassurance there. Occasionally diagnoses. Acne, hirsutism, mood swings, contraception and STI testing. And in my clinic, I'm actually doing transgender care now. But you can see there's a whole bunch of reasons why we are needed and needed care for adolescents. Right now, I've pretty much got the only practice in the state. I can't do it alone. Y'all, I need your help. Okay? Please. So, a 15-year-old comes into your office with very heavy and painful periods, dragged in by her mother kicking and screaming, usually. Terrified, right, that she's going to have to get undressed. She had menarche at age 12. Her menses were initially irregular, but now they're regular, lasting for about 10 days. She reports heavy menstrual bleeding. She's passing clots. She's changing a pad or tampon 6 to 8 times a day. She's got severe cramps. They're not relieved by ibuprofen or any other over-the-counter medication. And she's missing school for pain 2 days a month. How many of you all think that's okay? I mean, I personally need those extra 24 days a year. I can't just lay on the couch. So this girl obviously really needs our help. And we have to think about what are the common things that are happening in this age group. First of all, what is normal? Okay, there is an updated, in 2015, ACOG committee opinion describing the menstrual cycle in girls and adolescents, and then using it as a vital sign to tell how healthy they are. During the first 2 years after menarche, the cycles can be irregular, but 90% of girls are going to have a period somewhere between 21 and 45 days. The cycle length usually is 2 to 8 days. It is astounding to me how many girls I'll have to come to clinic who've been bleeding for 3 months, and their pediatrician says, it's okay, she's just in the first year after she started her cycles. I'm sorry, I don't ever want to bleed for 3 months in a row. Let alone when you're 13 and it's summer in Florida and you'd like to go to the beach and not be bitten by a shark. It's time. This is not okay. Right? Also, you need to have a break between those bleeds too. These girls need to be taken care of, not just ignored. So when do we really evaluate their cycles? We need to evaluate their cycles if they're less than 21 days in length or greater than 45. If they were initially regular and then they become irregular, if the flow lasts more than 7 days, or basically if a patient tells you she's bleeding too heavily, because now the definition from ACOG is if the patient says she's bleeding too heavily, she's got heavy menstrual bleeding. Okay, there we go. And it doesn't mean that you have to have calendars anymore. There are about 30 different menstrual tracking apps that you can get for your phone. The one that I've got pictured up there is the one that's the Cycle app. It's put out by the University of Stanford, but there's any one of them. And most of the girls that come into my office with their cell phone can tell me when they're getting their period because and how often they're getting and how often they're bleeding because they just flip open their phone app. There are lots and lots of these. All you have to do is put in Period Tracker app into the app store. We're all familiar with the Palm-Coeen FIGO classification of abnormal uterine bleeding, of heavy menstrual bleeding, and intermenstrual bleeding, and your structural and your non-structural causes. In adolescents, these are a little different, and I break it down into GYN causes and non-GYN causes. Overwhelmingly, and if you don't get anything else out of this presentation, overwhelmingly the main reason that adolescent girls bleed is because of anovulation and an immature HPO axis and major stress. That's the big thing. It totally flips out the cycles and they bleed prolonged. Pregnancy obviously can happen, we know this. Infections, and we'll go over that, especially chlamydia. Don't forget about endometriosis and trauma. We had a patient recently admitted to Arnold Palmer who came in for heavy menstrual bleeding. And we got her mom finally out of the room, and it turned out that this, I think she was 14 years old, had an intercourse with a 26-year-old neighbor and had a very large paracervical laceration. So although we don't normally, and you'll see me, hear me say this today, do exams on girls just for prolonged bleeding or anovulatory bleeding, obviously, if you have a history that's suggestive that there might be a trauma, you need to make sure you get the patient in a good place and do a good speculum exam with strong lighting and assess for this. Some of the non-gynecologic causes that are really common in teenagers are bleeding disorders, not clotting disorders, but bleeding disorders, especially von Willebrand's disease. I just came from the Florida Hemophilia Conference where I was asked to speak to the patients, to the women who had bleeding disorders, and their stories are astounding. There were a number of women there who were in their 30s and 40s who weren't diagnosed until much later, but they'd been bleeding heavily since they were teenagers. Always keep this on your radar. And then, of course, there's the things we do to people, the iatrogenic causes, IUD placement, Coumadin, and other things for DVTs. I like this slide because it shows what kinds of things should be on your mind based on the patient's age. So if you look, adolescent anovulation is really common. Of course, those of you who, the rest of everybody in the room that cares for women of all ages, see the similar kind of thing in the perimenopausal patients. But bleeding disorders also present early, as can endometriosis. Obviously, you can have a post-op complication at any time, but fibroids and other structural causes like polyps, those are really, really rare. Not impossible, but very rare in teenagers. And they all come in with their mother. Well, I've had fibroids. Clearly, my child is bleeding heavily. She's got fibroids. No, mommy, it's not that. Not usually. So I'm famous kind of in my clinic because I'm always drawing this out on table paper. But here's your HPO axis. In the hypothalamus, makes GnRH, and your pituitary makes FSH, you make estrogen and progesterone, and it builds up a lining, there's progesterone withdrawal, and then you get a menses. We have great artists at UCF. I love it. They got this great, poor Ryan has had to draw vulvas and bleeding and everything else. So everybody's familiar with the menstrual cycle in normal patients. In adolescence, this is what happens. Your hypothalamus triggers GnRH, make FSH, you make estrogen, it builds up an endometrium, and then the brain goes, ugh, that's enough. You don't actually ovulate. And so you get these cycles of estrogen and estrogen withdrawal that are usually still spaced out. They're anovulatory, but they can be much more irregular. So here's the crux of when it becomes a problem. When the brain starts to see the estrogen being made by the ovary. Normally, again, the FSH goes down and there's withdrawal of estrogen. But the adolescent brain can be lazy. The adolescent brain goes, I don't care if there's estrogen there, and it keeps pumping out FSH. And the ovary keeps making estrogen. And so you get this dilated arterioles and you get this buildup of endometrium. And you get then superficial shedding of the endometrium because essentially it's outgrown its blood supply. And this is the girl that comes in, and she's been bleeding all the time, these light, obnoxious spotting, and then she'll bleed for 3 days, and then it'll stop, because she's asynchronously shedding her endometrium. Until all of a sudden, the brain goes, ah, duh, I was supposed to suppress, and stops making the FSH. And then the estrogen completely falls, and then you get collapse of this massive, thick endometrium sitting in the uterus that then comes out at once. And then you've got this child that comes into the emergency room at 14, bleeding out, passing clots with a hemoglobin of 5. Same story, same kids. These are both anovulatory bleeders, but you've just now seen the end game of this, and it's the massive, heavy, prolonged bleeding. We'll get back to treatment of that. We had a great presentation yesterday by Dr. Taylor on endometriosis treatment, which is fascinating to me. I take care of a lot of girls and adolescents with endometriosis. And while the true incidence in adolescents is really unknown, there's a huge delay of about 10 years for diagnosis. In adolescents, though, these girls present with very, very painful and often very, very heavy treatment. I'm sorry, heavy bleeding, and it doesn't respond to treatment. You put them on birth control pills, and it may make their periods a little bit better sometimes, but then they'll keep having breakthrough bleeding, a lot of pain, and they bleed a lot heavier than what you would think. When you scope them, I don't want to blind Dr. Roussos-Ross, when you scope them, and it's difficult to see on here because it's difficult to see in laparoscopy, endometriosis looks like blebs with blood vessels that are coming out from underneath it. It doesn't always have that characteristic powder burn or bright red lesions that you'd see because it's in its early phase. It's in the inflammatory phase, and it causes severe pain. And I can do a whole separate talk on endometriosis in adolescents, but one of the big tricks if you're scoping adolescents, 16, 17-year-olds, for pelvic pain and suspectedosis, fill the peritoneal cavity with saline. Take your scope and dive underneath the water. And this is a trick taught by Mark Loffer at Harvard that is a very excellent one, that you can actually see the implants float up off of the peritoneal surface because it's still in this fluffy, looks just like endometrium, growing on top of these vessels. So why do they bleed? why does endometriosis produce bleeding? Well, in a normal endometrium, there's not aromatase expression in the endometrial cells. Also, normal endometrium produces the 17-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, which inactivates the estrogen. And the proliferative of estrogen influence is really balanced by the progesterone after ovulation. Well, the endometrium and the endometriosis implants could care less what you throw at it in terms of hormones. It makes its own aromatase. It does its own dang thing. It makes, and the 17-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, the type 2, doesn't exist, so it basically keeps producing estrogen, and it's very resistant to progesterone. So they get these thickened endometriums that bleed very heavily even when you feed them birth control pills. That's why they keep having pain. It's this locally produced estrogen that causes pain and all the bleeding. So think about that in these girls who aren't responding. Also, girlfriend could have chlamydia. Don't forget about chlamydia. Chlamydia, you know, a lot of our patients' parents think that the girls now are more sexually active than they were. It's a lie. Girls are actually less sexually active now. Only 44% of adolescent girls graduating high school have been sexually active. Back in the 90s, it was 78%. So we have no room to judge. But the rate of chlamydia continues to climb. And chlamydia ascends into the endometrial cavity. We've all had those patients who've done great with their IUDs. They've been fabulous on their birth control pills. They've not had any bleeding on their next Nexplanon, God bless them, because so many of them have. And they've been doing fine, and all of a sudden they're coming in and they're complaining of pain and bleeding. Don't forget to test them for chlamydia, because we know that there's a 70% progression to the upper genital tract. And if you biopsy specimens of women with abnormal bleeding who are of reproductive age, a significant number of them have chlamydia. So it's always a routine for me to check for chlamydia in these girls. This is not to make you seize and have PTSD, but briefly, we have to think of bleeding disorders in women who have heavy menstrual bleeding. And I finally understand this. It's taken a very long time, not saying my age, to get this. But essentially, that von Willebrand's factor floats around as a ball until there's a cut or an injury to an endothelial surface, and then it just unfurls itself and grabs onto platelets and pulls them back in and makes a clot. And if you have von Willebrand's type 1, you don't have any of that protein, and if you have type 2, you have lousy versions of it. Either they're too short to be able to grab onto the platelets, or they just don't bother to do it at all. If you've got type 3, you don't make it. I finally get it. It's that simple. So von Willebrand's disease is autosomal dominant inheritance. It's much more common than we think. There are other disorders of platelet function. There's Glanzmann's thrombocythemia. There's Bernard-Soulier. Basically, these are all disorders where the platelets don't form clots. What should put your radar up that somebody may have an underlying bleeding disorder? If they bleed for more than 15 minutes, these are all the CDC guidelines. If they have heavy or prolonged bleeding after surgical procedures, but my girls are 12 years old, 13 years old. If they're bleeding very heavily from their very first period, you've got to screen for these things. Nosebleeds lasting longer than 10 minutes, not just I picked my nose and it bled for 5 minutes, but because it's lasting longer than 10 minutes, or they actually had to seek medical attention for it, and it's happening recurrently. Heavy prolonged bleeding after dental extractions, which is less common again in teens. Blood in the stool. Anemia. If you're seeing a girl with heavy menstrual bleeding and she's anemic, again, that should put your radar up. You're passing clots greater than an inch in diameter or changing a pad or tampon more than hourly, and again, having anemia. Or you have a blood relative with a bleeding disorder, or her mama and her grandma and her aunt and her cousin all have had hysterectomies in their 30s for heavy menstrual bleeding. We all have those girls. They're all like, yeah, everybody in my family just bleeds heavily. It's just what we do. No, everybody in your family may have von Willebrand's disease. Hello. Let's find out. Okay. I'm a firm believer, and I teach this to the medical students, that if 95% of what you need to know is going to be in your patient history. You really need to take a good history, and you can find out almost everything you need to know before you start touching anybody. You need that full menstrual history, their age of menarche, how often her periods are, how heavy are they, any anemia symptoms. Does she feel like she's going to pass out? Well, yeah, all the teenagers do. They stand up fast, and now they all have POTS. But they do. They you know, lightheadedness, dizziness. Or she's been a track runner, and all of a sudden she's tired when she's running. Gum bleeds, nose bleeds, family history. Any prior use of contraception or attempts to manage the bleeding that hasn't gotten better. Sexual activity, of course, we all know never to ask that in front of a girlfriend's parents, and they never, you know. It's, how come it's the 17 and 3/4-year-old mother who won't leave the room? You know, my 12 and 13 and 14-year-old moms will leave, but it's the girl who, the mom's like, she's still a minor and I've still got control. So you say, you know what, I need a new urine specimen. That one kind of got lost, and you walk her to the bathroom and you ask her in private. We work it. We do it. Whatever it takes. and then any presence of dysmenorrhea. Really important histories of your past medical history, make sure you ask about migraines with aura, because really when it comes down to risk factors for VTE in girls using birth control pills, that's the big one that's the contraindication for estrogen in my patient base. They don't tend to have bad hypertension. It doesn't matter if they smoke or not, and usually they don't smoke in this generation. If they do smoke, it's weed, and that's not a contraindication. So it's okay. No, it's not okay, but that's a different talk. Most of them, we don't do, you ask about liver disease and kidney and gallbladder disease and seizure medication, especially Lamictal, because that one does tend to interfere with what you decide to use to control their bleeding. Finally, most important and shouldn't be relegated to the last line is I do a really detailed psychosocial history, as in what's going on in your life. And I get up all in their business. Who do you live with? I live with my mom and my sister. Where's your dad? Well, he's in jail. That's a problem. Or where's your dad? He lives across the street, and I go back and forth to their house, you know, every other weekend. That's important for what you're going to use for treatment of birth control pills. How's school? Fine. How are your grades? Great. What math are you taking? Algebra 1, and you're a senior in high school? That's a problem. Okay? Really tell me about your grades. Any bullying? Because major stressors in their life, in this day and age, I'm in Orlando. I've got all the people coming in from after Hurricane Maria, the Puerto Rican population. And they're really struggling. Some of them are living in hotels. Es un desastre. And so we really have to find out what's going on in their life, because if you take a lot of stress and you add that to an immature hypothalamic pituitary ovary axis, she bleeds. The brain can't keep up with the stress. It just gives up, and their hormones do this. So I do a focused physical exam. Obviously, you want to check for orthostatics, pallor, bruising, acanthosis, PCO is a whole other talk. I Tanner stage their breasts. Why is that relevant? Well, if you have a 12-year-old that comes in with heavy vaginal bleeding and she's got Tanner 1 breasts, this is the kid that could have had a sarcoma botryoides. This is the kid with a trauma. This is the kid you have to think of a vaginal mass. Because you're not supposed to be having periods if you're Tanner 1 or 2. You're supposed to be having periods if you're Tanner 3 or 4. Now, pubic hair Tanner staging is completely impossible in this day and age, because they turn 10, they see one pubic hair, and they shave it off. Or their mother does, which is kind of weird, too. But they do. I have these special needs kids that come in, and they've got no pubic hair. I'm like, what's going on? Well, you know, I took care of it for her. Okay. So Tanner staging of pubic hair is right out at this point. Okay. Now, it's nice to do an external exam sometimes, but I really don't push this hard for girls that have a history that's consistent with anovulatory vaginal bleeding. It's very unlikely. She's not going to have a cervical cancer, so I'm not going to see that. She's not going to have a vaginal mass. What am I going to find on a speculum exam? I know she's got a vagina and she's bleeding out of it. So unless I'm really suspecting something that's a mass, and there are those, or a trauma, you can really opt out of a speculum exam in these girls. And that's a huge relief. And they come in and they're all pale and they're sitting there about to break down in tears. And you say, girlfriend, you can keep your pants on. And all of a sudden you can get a history. All right, what do I order for labs? Yes, we check pregnancy tests liberally. You want a CBC, I know you all know this. Don't forget to get a ferritin though. because a lot of these girls will use up all their iron stores before they have become anemic. So anemia is kind of the end game. And girls with low ferritins have been shown to have increased fatigue, behavioral problems, concentration and school issues. So do check a ferritin. I think that's maybe the only one of the things that on this list that may not be intuitive. Get a PT, a PTT, a thrombin time or fibrinogen level if you suspect hypofibrinogenemia. I can say that. Get a von Willebrand's antigen, even if she's acutely bleeding. And the reason why I'm saying that is von Willebrand antigen release goes up in an acute bleed. So it should be relatively normal. It also goes up if you give estrogen. So people go, well, you can't screen for von Willebrand's disease during an acute bleed. You're right, you're not supposed to, and you're not supposed to check it when you're under hormones. However, if you check it and it's low, even in the setting of bleeding, you do have your diagnosis. It's worthwhile to know. So I would get a von Willebrand's antigen. And if they're really profoundly anemic, then don't forget a type and screen. What are my second and third tier testing? I mean, if she's sexually active, you've got to get a chlamydia test. If you don't know if she's sexually active, you get a chlamydia test. If she's peed in the cup, just send the chlamydia test, okay? All right. If she's irregular bleeding, I do check TSHs. We recently had a girl hospitalized at APH with prolonged menstrual bleeding for 4 months, and her TSH was in the 300s. So obviously that can cause it. That's because, remember back to studying for STEP exams, that alpha subunit of your TSH looks just like FSH and LH. And if they've got a really high TSH, it binds in their ovary, and the ovary gets very confused and starts pumping out a lot of estrogen, and they become anovulatory. If you suspect PCOS, you can get your androgen studies and your liver function tests. If you think that she might have such bad liver disease that she's got a coagulopathy, I think it's very unlikely. And third tier really is for a hematologist to order those platelet function assays. That gets beyond my pay grade. Ultrasound. Now, ultrasound is phenomenal for ovarian masses and adnexal masses. It's just not that useful for bleeding, and I certainly wouldn't hold off treatment because she don't have an ultrasound. The chances that she's got a fibroid or a malignancy are basically almost nil. You can get a sense of how thick her endometrium is, and sometimes it's a really nice teaching tool when her endometrial thickness is 1.8 centimeters. And, of course, you get back abnormal endometrial thickness could have hyperplasia. She's 14. She doesn't have hyperplasia. She's anovulatory. You can show the mom, see how thick this lining is? That's because she's not ovulating. We're going to make this better. But also, when she finally does have a withdrawal bleed after we stop the bleeding, it's going to be heavy. You can look for Mullerian anomalies. This is one of my patients who had a non-communicating uterine horn that was having severe pain. Leiomyoma, pretty rare. Every now and then you can get a juvenile granulosa cell tumor. But in all reality, there's a recent study that's come out that shows that the data doesn't support that you need to have an ultrasound. So it doesn't have to be done. Now, this is, again, one of those key things I want you to remember from this talk. When it comes to birth control pills for teens, old school is best if they're bleeding. These are not the girls to give low estrin to. These are not the girls to give orthotricycline. I know they've got samples. These are not the kids to give low dose. And their mamas all say, I'm on this low dose pill. She's just a baby. She just needs low dose. Your daughter doesn't listen to you, and your daughter's uterus is not going to listen to a piddly little dose of 10 micrograms of estrogen. You need to give them something that it's going to respond to. So give them 30 mics of ethinyl estradiol at least, and give them levonorgestrel or norgestrel. These are kids. They're not going to clot. They're not going to get a DVT. The risk is incredibly low. And you want to use a second-generation progesterone like levonorgestrel or norgestrel. So which are those? That's your old-fashioned low overall, which has a generic Chrysel. Or now the levonorgestrel, which used to be Nordet, and those of us who color are gray know about Nordet, because that's an old one. It's actually available at Walmart. I have no skin in the game with them, but it's on their $9 plan as Curvelo. And why is that important? Because many insurance plans, if you've got a 12-year-old that's bleeding heavily, including Florida Medicaid, do not want to cover birth control pills for the kids. But if you can get $9 Crevello at Walmart, you can treat their heavy bleeding. And most families can afford the $9. What you do is you put them on the pill, and you counsel them that the first pill menstrual withdrawal that they have is going to be very heavy because they've had this dysfunctional endometrium that's there, but then it'll get lighter and lighter and lighter. If their hemoglobin is 11, they can start it once a day. You want to make sure you give them iron supplementation. And this is something really pretty cool I just learned. Most of us start iron BID if they're anemic, right? I just learned that you can give it once a day or even every other day, which is how most kids take it anyway, and get the same effect because as you give higher doses of iron, the hemosiderin level that rises prevents more absorption. So actually using it once a day is fine for kids. If your bleeding's heavy, hemoglobin's 8 to 10, you want to do an OC taper. So usually you want to stop it pretty quickly. So we'll use the OC's, the second generation progesterones, TID for 3 days, BID for 3 days. Actually, it should be QID, TID, BID. And then daily for 21 days. I apologize for the typo. I bring them back in and check their hemoglobin before you allow a withdrawal bleed. Because if their hemoglobin is still 8, I don't want them to bleed heavily. And I'll keep them on continuous OCs until their hemoglobin is at least above 10 before I let them have a period. And then again, you warn them that the period's going to be heavy. And you say, repeat back after me, your period's going to be heavy because it really scares them when you've just been managing their heavy bleeding. How long do you keep them on? That's every mother's question. My baby, she's 13. I'm like, yeah, your baby bleeds like a stuck pig. But at least 6 months is what I recommend patients. Okay. How do you treat the really severely heavy bleeding? You hospitalize them if her hemoglobin's usually less than 8. Sometimes I've gone lower. She's symptomatic, actively bleeding heavily. Now, I hate transfusions in kids, and it's been a real battle with sometimes in my hospital. I've sent girls home as long as they've stopped bleeding and they're not symptomatic with a hemoglobin of 5 and even 4-9. As long as I know they've got good follow-up and they're not symptomatic and they can walk without passing out, they're okay. Why? Because I don't want them to get isoimmunization. These are the same girls that are going to have babies later. Ked kills, Duffy dies, yeah, no. I try to avoid transfusions if at all possible in my girls. A lot of people are from the old school of, if I'm going to give them blood, I may as well just give them 2 units. What? That makes no sense in an adolescent because they don't need that much blood. You give 1 unit, check their symptoms, check their hemoglobin. And this is changing with national guidelines. It's changing with blood bank guidelines. If your hospital's not on board yet, get them on board. Most adolescents are healthy. They're not these oncology patients who are sick, who've got underlying cardiovascular disease, or who are geezers. Our patients are young. They're healthy. They can handle it. How do you manage their bleeding? Because, of course, we have to stop their bleeding. Don't you love the consult? Well, we're giving her blood. I'm like, is she still bleeding? Did you give her anything to stop the bleeding? No. It's still running out. Okay, we need to stop the, put the plug in the drain. So you can use a 50 mic pill every 6 hours. That's usually in the form of overall at our institution of ethanol estradiol and norgestrel. If she can't take PO because she's nauseous from the high-dose estrogen, you can use the conjugated equine estrogen, 25 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. 90% of the time it stops the bleeding after 3 doses. You switch to OCs when the bleeding stopped, and you continue them again at least 6 months. High-dose estrogen causes nausea. Make sure you give ondansetron at the same time. The other thing I like to do if they're hospitalized is I give IV iron while they're in the hospital because these girls are non-compliant. They're teenagers. So we give them IV iron as a boosted up, you're hospitalized anyway. Now, I'm not covering in this talk other things that are surgical, but if you have a girl, and it's very rare, that doesn't respond to this kind of management, and you're going to take her to the OR, You can use a 30cc Foley. You don't have to inflate it all the way to mechanically compress the endometrium and stop bleeding as well. You don't use a Bakri balloon in a child who's never had a kid before. But you can use the same sort of mindset and put a Foley in. In general, endometrial curettage, a DNC does not help these girls. There's not really a good place for it. If they can't take estrogen or they can't tolerate it, my favorite drug is Northendrone. I love that stuff, and I use 5 to 10 milligram doses. You can start with every 6 hours if you need to, if they're bleeding heavily, and then taper them to once a day. You can also use medroxyprogesterone, 10 to 20 milligrams, every 6 to 12 hours to stop bleeding for whatever reason they can't take estrogens. Don't give Depo Provera. One, it's lousy for stopping acute bleeding. You can't titrate it. You can't get it back out. This is not the setting. Now, I love Depo Provera for other reasons, but in the setting of acute, heavy bleeding, this is not the time to use Depo Provera. We're all using a lot more antifibrinolytics, especially tranexamic acid. A lot of times, at least in our EMR at our institution, I put in tranexamic acid at the same time I put in her birth control pills, and I get the alert, alert, she's going to clot. Actually, the data doesn't support that at all. And I'm working on the new ACOG guidelines for treating adolescents with bleeding disorders, and you'll see in that statement that it is perfectly okay to use tranexamic acid, to use Urolystedt with birth control pills, especially in the adolescent population. So if you need both to stop their bleeding, it's fine. I love IUDs, and in my girls with bleeding disorders and persistently heavy periods, we are using a lot of them, and it has been shown to be very effective. Now, obviously, I'm not putting them in the hospital in acute heavy bleeding, but if you have a child that has persistent heavy bleeding or has a bleeding disorder, you can definitely use levonorgestrel. In my office, I do paracervical blocks on everybody because my girls are nulliparous, and it opens the cervix up. The data on misoprostol is not good, and in fact, the recommendation to use it has been pulled. So I like a good paracervical block. If we could use it for other things, it's great for this. And I always play music. I have put in IUDs to everything from country music to Rihanna to Lil Wayne, you name it. We just put it in. It's whatever she wants to hear. It really works. So why do I take care of teens? This is one of my patients who came in a couple months ago. I love this shirt, right? Why be racist, sexist, homophobic, or transphobic when you could just be quiet? This is a great shirt. This is one of my girls. They are really more open-minded, and they say exactly what they think. You can probably tell that that's my world. That's kind of how I roll. They're also very interested in learning about their bodies and really respond well to education. And I get to watch them evolve from these angst-filled, miserable, pimpled 12, 13-year-olds to these really beautiful, independent, strong women. And that is such a treat. And then I send them off to you all. Your mom, okay? How do you make your own office friendly? The ACOG Adolescent Guide that came out has a letter for parents that explains, yes, I'm going to talk to your daughter alone. And why? It has a whole list of frequently asked questions from adolescents and helpful for triage and phone for your nursing. It's got parent questionnaires and patient questionnaires, tips for setting up an adolescent-friendly office, confidentiality information, and then for tips for talking to teens. Like, sit lower than them in the exam room. Don't stand. Basic stuff. The EMR just kills me sometimes. I try to be really careful about what I document and who has access to it. Recently, our institution outsourced our EMRs and all the and our records. And so we had an episode of one of my adolescents who I'd written strictly confidential, sexually active, mother doesn't know, in the psychosocial history that had automatically been redacted by our staff. They outsourced it, and they sent it to her mother when requested. That was a really ugly situation, and so we had to get in touch with the medical records company that was really unfamiliar with this. So be very careful. I've now developed a whole separate psychosocial note that company now knows they don't have to redact anything. The psychosocial note just does not go to her mother. I always, always, always get my adolescent's phone number. And some of the moms will go, you can't have her number. You have to call me. And I'll say, it's not going in the database. She won't get any phone calls. It's going in my own personal note. God forbid she's at school and has a disaster and she's not with you and I need to reach her. Usually that works. What are some helpful resources for your patients and their parents? I do have a list of phone apps for tracking menstrual cycles. Bedsider, if you've not seen it, is an awesome nonprofit organization with wonderful posters, handouts on contraception. They'll send patients sassy pill message reminders on text. Futures Without Violence is a website that has wonderful handouts on hanging out or hooking up and relationship safety that I just keep around. And when the girl's picking up and reading it and taking it with her, especially when it talks about intimate partner violence, it's a thing that you can, it's a conversation starter. And then I have a book list up here. If you ever need to call me, I have my slides are on the app. Call me or send me an email. I know that our practice is busy and we're in Orlando and y'all are every place else. I don't mind a curbside from anybody about anything. And thanks.